TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. The War on Freedom, How and Why America Was Attacked on September 11. An interview with the author, Nafees Mossadegh Ahmed. Part 1. Very soon after the events of 9/11, questions were raised about the fact that no planes were sent up to intercept the hijacked planes, and about the insider trading of airline stocks right before the 9/11 attack, about the person of Mohammed Atta, and the role of the Pakistani intelligence service. Relatives of some of the victims of 9/11 and members of Congress demanded an independent inquiry. Vice President Cheney's resistance raised more questions. What did the Bush administration know about the preparation of the 9/11 attack, and when did they know it? Nafees Mossadegh Ahmed is the executive director of the British-based Institute for Policy Development Research. His book, The War on Freedom, is the most comprehensive effort yet to explore these questions. Here is Nafees Ahmed, reached by phone in his home in England. In your book, you refer to a statement by former National Security Advisor Brzezinski that the U.S. wants to dominate the globe, and he refers to the need for an external threat. Was 9/11 such an event, and is Iraq the next step?
Brzezinski, in his book, which was published by the Council on Foreign Relations, he goes into a lot of detail about the plans and strategies of the U.S. foreign policy establishment in terms of expanding the role of the United States around the world in order to dominate the world, specifically in order to dominate those parts of the world which are strategic due to their energy resources and so on, and strategic in terms of their implications for world control. And one of the things that Brzezinski recognized and acknowledged in his book, in just about one or two paragraphs, is that in order to justify that kind of huge military interventionism, you need to have some kind of external threat by which to justify that policy. And he specifically talked about the idea of having a Pearl Harbor-type incident, which would provide the emotional impetus in terms of affecting the American psyche, the American people, to make them support such a massive interventionist policy. And I don't think that there is any doubt at all that the September 11th terrorist attacks did provide a similar kind of, just the kind of Pearl Harbor-type impact that then justified what the administration is now doing under the guise of the war on terrorism. And what gives, I think, credence to this idea is the fact that almost every single thing that the Bush administration is doing now is really simply carrying out plans, strategies, which are available in declassified secret documents, available in various published documents, and also available on the press, which detail what this administration and previous administrations had been planning in terms of expanding American power throughout the world. And under the guise of the war on terror, that's what the Bush administration is now doing in the aftermath of September 11th. And September 11th has definitely provided the justification and the pretext for doing those things.
You mentioned previously a number of think tank documents, and among them the Project for the New American Century. Can you include that into the conversation here?
Yeah, the Project for a New American Century is a neoconservative think tank in the United States. They did a study which was essentially sponsored by Bush's cabinet. But before he even came to power, the people who were involved in sponsoring the study, if I remember correctly, it was Paul Wolfowitz was one of them, Jeb Bush, who is Bush's brother. There was Donald Rumsfeld, I think, was also involved.
I believe Cheney too.
Yeah, Dick Cheney was definitely involved. And the study was basically a piece of research to look into, in no uncertain terms, and this is, I mean, literally quoting the document, how to establish a Pax Americana, you know, which is basically an American empire in colonial language. It talks about how the United States must go into these countries, and it names a whole host of regions, which now the United States government is saying are threats toward peace in the aftermath of September 11th, and is now saying we should go and do something about those places. For example, Iran, Syria, even China. The document focuses on China and says that we need a regime change in China, which of course is, I mean, in terms of the impact on world order that such a policy would have in entering into a confrontation with China, no anybody can see that we're talking about something which could escalate into a nuclear war. We're talking about a new kind of Cold War. And it also talks about, the document also talks about Iraq. And interestingly, it talks about how the need to get into Iraq and get American troops into the Gulf region transcends the issue of Saddam Hussein. Whether or not Saddam Hussein poses a threat, we need to have American troops in the Gulf. The whole document is essentially a blueprint for world domination, and that is how it was described by one of Scotland's leading newspapers, the Sunday Herald. And it really is this. It really is, in every step of the way, a very clearly defined, step-by-step paving the way for the current war on terrorism. Everything that President Bush and the current administration is doing now was laid out in this document, you know, before the elections even took place, which is, it really is shocking, to be honest.
What was interesting to see was that Jeb Bush was actually one of the sponsors of the project for the New American Century document. Can you talk a little bit more about his role in the days before 9/11?
Yeah, just 2 days before September 11th, I think, he signed a declaration for a state of emergency in the state of Florida. It was an order, basically, for the National Guard, which he signed, an executive order, basically acknowledging that there was a state of emergency, and the Guard had to be out on the streets. And essentially, the order that he signed was a declaration of martial law, and that was noted by various different reports who actually analyzed the documents. And anyone can actually see if they go to the executive orders are there, available on the website of the state of Florida. And it really does show that Jeb Bush, for some reason or other, had anticipated that there was going to be some kind of crisis. And anticipating that, took this action of declaring a state of emergency and declaring martial law legally. There seems to be no other explanation for that kind of action, except to say that it was so close to September 11th, he must have had some kind of advanced warning that some kind of crisis, September 11th, was going to take place.
You also mention in your book the relationship of the Bush and Bin Laden family and the interconnection with the Carlyle Group. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, the Carlyle Group is it's a giant defense conglomerate. It's actually a huge investment firm, but it invests very, very, very heavily in defense. And on the board of Carlyle are many, many people formerly from the U.S. government, including James Baker and different Frank Carlucci, a lot of other prominent people, but most specifically, President Bush's father, the former president, works for Carlyle. He does speeches for Carlyle. Apparently, he does consulting for them. And what's interesting, really, is that the Carlyle Group, which is obviously connected to the Bush family via the role of Bush's father, is also connected to the Bin Laden family, because the Bin Laden family, prior to September 11th, and also after September 11th for a while, had a rather huge investment in Carlyle. And so this, essentially, through the Carlyle Group, we have the Bush family and the Bin Laden family set to make money out of defense. And of course, in the aftermath of September 11th, defense became the order of the day. And we had huge investment in defense-related projects as a result of the militarization of U.S. foreign policy in the aftermath of September 11th under the guise of the war on terrorism. Basically, what happened after that is that the Bin Laden family pulled out their stake in Carlyle.
In the context of this, could you tell that story about the plane picking up the members of the Bin Laden family right after 9/11? That is such an odd story.
Yeah, that's a very odd story. There are different reports, actually. There are always conflicting reports about what happens in relation to these issues. CBS News, I think, was one source that reported how, in the aftermath of September 11th, supposedly about a week after the attacks or something like that, members of the Bin Laden family were just shipped out of the United States by under FBI supervision, supposedly to protect them, because there was worries about there being a public outcry and that the Bin Laden family would become a target or something like that. And so they basically organized, the FBI organized several flights, I think, private flights out of the country and just took them away. And that was it. There was no investigation into these people. You know, there was no attempt to say, okay, these are members of the family. There have been, and there definitely are, FBI investigations into members of the Bin Laden family with relation to support of terrorism and in specific relation to the support of Osama bin Laden. And yet the whole family was just shipped out. That, some would say, is an indication of complicity with regards to the administration. And there is a report which makes the whole thing 10 times worse in the Tampa Tribune, which actually quoted a bodyguard. I think it was actually quoted two bodyguards who were present on the flight of one of these private jets. And this report said that the private jet had actually taken off, I think, 2 days after September 11th. And as we know, there was a crackdown on all flights and all airports everywhere throughout the whole country 3 days after the September 11th attacks occurred. There wasn't supposed to be any flights taking off anywhere. Everything was blocked. The only way a private jet could take off like that within that period was if it had high-level government approval.
In your book, you talk about how both the Clinton and Bush administrations had opportunities to have bin Laden extradited, Clinton from the Sudan and Bush from Pakistan, and that would have been without a war or loss of life. And in each instance, the government refused. Can you tell that story from your book?
Yeah, sure. The Clinton administration had, I think, many offers from the government of Sudan to extradite Osama to the United States. At that time, it was in 1996, around that time, that Osama bin Laden was actually living in the Sudan. And according to the Sudanese government, he had been under heavy, and this has been corroborated now by documents which have been released by the Sudanese government, but that he had been heavily monitored by Sudanese intelligence. They were tracking him, they were tracking his followers, they were tracking people he knew, people he met, they were tracking their projects, their operations. They had, everything was covered. And the Sudanese government said to the United States administration at that time, the Clinton administration, that you know, we can hand him over to you. And the Clinton administration wasn't interested. They said, you know, we don't want him, because, and there was a number of explanations given for that now. One of the explanations is that there was never any point in taking Osama at that time, because they didn't have any evidence that would be sufficient enough to convict him in a court of law in the United States, and they would have to let him go free, and that would be a downfall for the United States and for the fight against terrorism. That's what the official explanation is for why they didn't bother accepting these very, potentially very, very peacemaking offers from Sudan in terms of ending terrorism from Al-Qaeda. that explanation doesn't really make any sense, because John O'Neill, who is the he's the late FBI agent who died in the World Trade Center attacks, because he was head of security there at that time. But he was a former FBI special agent who was head of the anti-terrorism investigation in Yemen in relation to the bombing that occurred there against the U.S. targets. And he basically said that the State Department had blocked the investigation into the incident at Yemen and had prevented him and his team from accessing evidence of Osama bin Laden's involvement. And he was furious at this. He was interviewed by the two French intelligence analysts who authored the book The Forbidden Truth, which I think is out now. It's published by Nation Books. And this is significant because it really does show that the evidence was available to the administration, but because they knew that if they had the evidence, they would actually have to act on it or do something with it and actually, for example, accept Sudan's offer, they just blocked the investigations, prevented access to the evidence, and then said, because we don't have the evidence, we can't accept your offer to the Sudanese government because we don't really want to. There have been people in the intelligence community, for example, in the CIA. There was one CIA official quoted in the Village Voice who basically said that this policy was a joke. They had the clear chance to get Osama, but they missed it. And that seems to show that there is something more going on with the U.S. policy. And the Bush administration, after September 11th, simply continued the same general policy of not really being very interested in getting Osama. It was General Mahmoud Ahmed from the ISI, the Pakistani ISI, to negotiate with the Taliban just before the bombing of Afghanistan. They were negotiating the handover of Osama bin Laden, and they had actually reached an agreement and proposed to the United States that the Taliban will hand over Osama to Pakistan, and they will let the trial go ahead in Pakistan, and we won't have him then. And that will be at least one step closer to U.S. control, for the United States getting control of Osama or having access to him in some way. The U.S. government didn't even negotiate. It just said point blank, no, we don't want that. We want to have a war instead. And that's what they had. They had their war.
Let's go into more detail into the events of 9/11. Why was there no order given to scramble planes?
Why was there no order given? I mean, the reality is that there doesn't seem to have been an order given to scramble planes at the right time. On the morning of September 11th, we had four planes hijacked within the space for about 20 minutes. And by that time, the Federal Aviation Administration had known full well that there was an unprecedented emergency in the skies, that four planes were on the loose. And we should all remember that, I mean, they're tracking everything that happens over the skies all the time. And they were monitoring the progress of the events. They were monitoring the progress of these hijacked planes. But nothing happened. Nothing happened for 1.5 hours until after the Pentagon was attacked. And according to Richard Myers, again, who was acting chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff on that day, he testified before the Senate on 13 September. He was asked by the senators that why didn't we scramble planes in time to prevent the attacks from taking place? Why was there such an unprecedented failure of U.S. air defense? We want to know the answer. And Myers just said to them that we only managed to scramble planes until after the Pentagon was attacked. He was asked that question three times, and he gave the same answer each time. I mean, the fact has been corroborated by other sources just a few days after the attacks. I mean, there was a NORAD spokesman, General Mike Snyder, who was quoted in the Boston Globe saying the same thing, that we only scrambled planes until 15 minutes after the Pentagon was attacked, something like that. And Vice President Dick Cheney confirmed the same thing on NBC. He had a conversation with the journalist, I think his name was Tim Russert or something, and Tim Russert asked him the same thing about, you know, what happened with the Pentagon, and he said the same thing. We didn't manage to scramble planes in time to save the Pentagon. And so we have basically, in the early days after September 11th, this admission on the part of various people in the government, people in power, that there was this failure to scramble planes on time. And, you know, nothing was done for 1.5 hours, approximately, in terms of scrambling military jets to protect the skies in America. And the question that needs to be asked is, why was there this failure? And it is a failure, because according to standard operating procedures, which are carried out by the FAA and by the Pentagon routinely and mandatorily, it's a compulsory procedure that must be followed and is routinely followed all the time. The standard procedure for military jets to be scrambled to intercept a commercial airliner if there is even a minor emergency, such as the plane flying off course. And so if it flies off course and you can't establish radio contact with the plane, or even if you can, you can't solve the problem, then you have to scramble a military jet to go up there, investigate the situation, try and communicate with the pilot via various wingtip, specialized wingtip movements, etc., to see what's going on, and if necessary, even to have a whole number of escort craft in order to, if necessary, push the craft, force the craft to move out of a certain airspace, etc., etc. These are normal procedures which anyone can actually read them online. They're available at the website of the Federal Aviation Administration in manuals that are read by pilots. And for some strange reason, these procedures completely collapsed on September 11th, as Myers himself admitted. You know, for 1.5 hours, there was no response. And I think that responsibility for this massive failure can certainly be located at the doorstep of top government officials. I mean, Dick Cheney, in his conversation with the journalists on NBC, actually admitted. He actually said that the decision to scramble planes was a White House level decision. It was made by the president. He was talking in context with why there was a failure to scramble planes, and he was trying to actually give an explanation to say that at that time we didn't know what was going on, so that's why we failed to scramble planes on time. But the important point is, of course, that if the decision was made by the president, then that seems to imply that there was a White House-level decision to put some kind of stand-down order, quite literally, because standard operating procedures are implemented not on White House orders, but simply when a situation or an emergency arises, and are followed through by people on the ground, by pilots, by air traffic controllers, by military people in the Pentagon, automatically, just to get sort these situations out, because they happen every day in the skies over America, and they've happened every day for decades, and these institutions are quite used to handling these kind of developments in the skies. But these procedures were completely ignored, and if the president had intervened in those procedures and he had made the decision to scramble planes, and Dick Cheney has said this, then I think we have a very clear statement of admission on the part of a senior government official that the Bush administration was involved, heavily involved, in the failure of U.S. air defense, directly involved, and directly responsible. What we then need to ask is, why was there a decision made to do it so late? You know, and it's quite interesting. If we actually go to the statement of President Bush himself, President Bush said it was at a town hall meeting in Florida, and there was a young kid who asked him a question. That he asked, why did we not manage to do anything on September 11th? We're the greatest country in the world. We've got the greatest military, greatest air force. What happened? Why did we fail? And President Bush, he stood up there, and he started to go through this kind of general chronology of what happened. He said, I wanted to know the facts. Before I did anything, I wanted to know the facts. So what I did is, I got on the phone when I got on Air Force One, and then I got the facts from the Defense Secretary, and then I put our emergency operations into gear. When he was on Air Force One, that was about an hour after he had first been told of this of the attacks. Again, it was after the Pentagon was hit. So he had waited all that time after being told in the classroom that, you know, these attacks are occurring, and he hadn't said a thing. At what level and how far did this systematic orchestrated negligence go, that we had the president not doing anything, Dick Cheney admitting to not doing anything, the defense secretary involved in not doing anything, Myers standing in front of the Senate saying, yeah, you know, we didn't scramble planes on time. This is very clear. There is this circle of systematic negligence. Is it complicity? I believe it's complicity. It doesn't matter whether I believe it's complicity or conspiracy or anything. The fact is that this is what happened. There was this failure, and the government was responsible. People in the government did nothing for so long. And I think that we need to ask hard questions, and we need to put these people in power under review and impeach them and hold them to account for what, at the very least, is criminal negligence.
That was Nafees Mossadegh Ahmed, executive director of the British-based Institute for Policy Development Research. His book, The War on Freedom, How and Why America Was Attacked on September 11, is an effort to explore the many strange incidents that took place in the United States and around the world leading up to 9/11. You can reach Nafees Ahmed on his website, www.globalresearch.org. That's globalresearch.org. This is part one of a two-part program. In the next broadcast, you will hear about the background of the so-called lead hijacker, Mohammed Atta, and the question, was this done on purpose in order to prepare war, first on Afghanistan and now Iraq? I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on the War on Freedom on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information how to order a copy of this program on the War on Freedom by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 877-882-8273. Time of Useful Consciousness is an aeronautical term, the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for the pilot to save the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.